plus, oh, by the way, has a full caseload of patients and has a family and three children, I'm totally convinced this man does not sleep. But lucky for us, whether he sleeps or not, he's here. So please help me give a round of huge applause for Dr. Andrew Freeman.
Thank you. I'm trying to get my mic here working. Test, test. Test, test. Test. All right, we just got to make it a little louder, I think. All right, well, thanks for having me. For those of you that have seen me before, I am indeed a local cardiologist. Every year, it's just the foam ball. And every year I try my best to put together a talk about what the latest literature is showing, the evidence behind why plant-based diets are so important to us. First, I would invite you all to start helping us to spread the word by simply taking a picture of your favorite speaker or food or neighbor or whatever and posting it on social media so people know that this is going on and so that we can really get the word out there about how important this is for health. So every year, like I said, I try to kind of comb through the literature and get the best possible evidence that's out there. And so this is what this is this year. And I have no relevant disclosures to this presentation. I thought I would start with an interesting comic here. It says, we kill billions of animals, destroy rainforests, poison the environment, and sell your products that are killing you. Thanks for your support. And believe it or not, this is not just McDonald's, but a lot of the food industry is unfortunately gotten so big that they've lost their sort of mission, if you will, and they don't really care about what their products do to the public. So be wary. And I also wanted to give a quick plug. If you haven't seen this video on YouTube, it's called Carnism by Dr. Joy, and she is just an absolute fantastic speaker. And I would invite you to Google this and look at it. You can watch it on YouTube. An interesting video about the reasons why people won't give up their normal, typical American diets that are hurting them. And then before I jump into anything useful, I always try to show this slide because the number one question I get every single day is, Doc, am I getting enough protein? So first, I want people to remember that elephants and gorillas are Earth's biggest vegans, right? They are gigantic. They're mostly muscle. I wouldn't mess with one. All they do is eat leaves. So I would tell you that in general, protein is never a problem. In this country, to be protein deficient, you would have to work really hard to do that. So what I would tell you is if you look pound for pound, spinach, kale, broccoli actually have much more protein than many of the meats that we have enjoyed in the past if you were a meat eater at any point. And finally, I will put out there that even with the best possible nutrition research, it is impossible to do a perfect study. It's just not possible. You'd have to lock people up and force feed them. A lot of the studies are observational, meaning we've looked for trends, but we can't always find the reason for why these trends exist. So let's jump into a really important topic that's in Colorado, which is childhood obesity. As you may know, Colorado is, quote, the healthiest state, and also happens to have one of the largest childhood obesity epidemics in the country. There's an interesting dichotomy, and no one knows the exact mechanism. Some of it may be socioeconomic, and some of it may be other factors we're not sure of. But remember that when you're obese as a child, your risk in later life is actually a lot higher. And there was a small study here that showed that if you followed about 30 children for a month and you fed them a low-fat vegan diet, all of the biomarkers that we know that are associated with high-risk cardiology issues go away. Pretty amazing. And if you look at another larger study here of about 2,500 participants that were followed for 20 years, if you consume 9 servings of fruit and vegetables, you had less plaque accumulate in your arteries, less clogging of those arteries. And you were a quarter less likely to have heart disease when you compare those to people who haven't had them. And even further, another study showed that if you look at about 2,200 adolescent females as part of the NHLBI's growth and health study followed for 10 years, they follow their diet records, and if you consumed more potassium, which comes in the form of plants, you had lower diastolic blood pressure and systolic blood pressure later in life, which of course is a huge marker for how people are going to do. So it's important to remember that when you have families and friends and you see their kids eating boxes of macaroni and cheese, that maybe you say something if you're able to, because it's really not a good thing. How about coffee, right? Everybody loves coffee, and it's turning out it really is our friend. So if you look, there was a very large study that was done in a Swedish study, and they tracked about 5,000 people total. This is a small subset of them. And this was in multiple sclerosis. And in short, if you had 6 cups of coffee a day, you were a third less likely to develop multiple sclerosis. But now let's look at an even bigger study. 25,000 people in South Korea without known heart disease. And the coffee drinkers were less likely to have calcium in their coronary arteries, which is a marker for sludge in the pipes, so to speak. And the relationship was U-shaped. So what does that mean? So if you look here on the bottom, the graph from the study shows cups of coffee. And if you look at the middle line, the dark black line, that's the one we're looking at, basically, if you went out to about 4 cups a day or 3.5 cups a day, it seemed that your risk was the lowest. So in short, if you don't drink enough coffee, your risk is higher. If you drink too much coffee, your risk is higher. But if you drink just the right amount, then that's where you want to be. But what about colon cancer? So if you look at colon cancer, if you had 4 cups a day of coffee, you had a much lower risk, a 42% reduction in developing colon cancer. Now, I would caution you that if this is plain old black coffee, right? So if you put in cream and sugar, where I trained in Rhode Island, there was Dunkin' Donuts in every corner. The thing that everyone walked away with was the extra extra. Anyone know what that is? So that was extra cream, extra sugar, and basically you got this big white cup. So don't do that. But nonetheless, 42% risk reduction. And if you look at an even bigger study, 75,000 women, 93,000 women, and 41,000 men in the Nurses Health and Health Professionals follow-up study, they did a questionnaire and they followed people. And in short, one cup of coffee dropped your risk of dying from any cause by 6%. 3 cups went up to 8%. 5 cups went up to 15% risk reduction, and this is per day. But if you went over 5 cups, that's when you ended up in trouble. And it really has to be caffeinated, not decaf. So try, if you're drinking coffee, not to exceed 5 cups a day, which is a lot of coffee, by the way. All right, so the question I often get is, well, what about sugar-sweetened beverages? Can I put sugar in my coffee? Can I put sugar in my tea? And I would tell you to try to avoid that. The goal is to have unsweetened versions. So if you look at a population that was 42,000 men, 45 to 79 years of age, followed for roughly 12 years, the men who had just 2 servings a day of sweetened beverages had a much higher risk of developing heart failure. Now, many of you may know that there is a sweet tea phenomenon that is coming over this country. It's a wave of danger, I call it. It started in the South. But basically, it's a giant pile of sugar with a little bit of tea. And that's what they call sweet tea. I don't recommend you drink that. It's like drinking Kool-Aid, which I also would recommend against. So in short, the goal would be unsweetened tea, unsweetened coffee. So let's switch gears a little bit. There was some talk about whole grains. Everyone's saying, oh, carbs are the enemy, carbs are the enemy. And I would agree that if you're trying to lose weight, eating a lot of carbs is probably not in your best interest. However, if you are eating grains that are highly processed, like most Americans, white carbs, white rice, white pretzels, white crackers, whatever it might be, it may not be ideal. And in this study, they looked at 18 other studies and looked at about 400,000 people. The highest whole grain intake amount compared with the lowest had a marked decrease in coronary heart disease, over 20%, which is pretty amazing. And then this year, and again, all my talks are based on the last years of data, so this is 2015, but it was the first ever meta-analysis of lipids, and it was a meta-analysis, meaning a study of all the studies of the best possible kind, which are randomized controlled trials. And what they looked at is basically that if you were a vegetarian, your cholesterol dropped about 14 points on the U.S. scale. This is pretty powerful stuff. You know, to drop 14 points of cholesterol just by switching your diet around without any pills is pretty good. A lot of people can't get that much even with Lipitor or Crestor or the drugs that we like to put people on. So in short, basically what it's showing, though, is that there's a dietary effect of cholesterol. And there's a lot of people out there, including the egg industry, which is notorious for this, that's trying to tell us that if you eat eggs, which are very high in cholesterol, that they are healthy for you and it won't have an effect on your cholesterol. Well, this has been disproven. And if you look at the EPIC lifestyle study, which was a very large, almost 500,000 people in Europe, they were followed for 12 years. If you had a highest fruit and vegetable intake, your risk of heart attack dropped by about a fifth. We can't get these numbers with drugs, right? I always tell my patients the best way that I can reduce your risk is the way you live. And what they tell me is, doc, give me a pill. And we have to really change that phenomenon in this country or we're going to be broke by next year. Colon cancer, again, in this study, this was the Adventist health study. So for those of you not familiar with the Seventh-day Adventist, it's a religious movement. They started in Loma, or their headquarters right now is in Loma Linda, California. Anybody know anything about Loma Linda? Yeah, so Loma Linda is where people go and they live forever for whatever reason, but probably because they eat plants. So Seventh-day Adventists follow a vegetarian diet if they're religious. And in parts of the world where they follow this diet, Loma Linda being one of them, their longevity is off the charts compared to the rest of the country. So in this study, they followed about 80,000 adults. They divided into five dietary groups, vegan, lacto-ovo, besco-vegetarian, all these things. One of my coworkers jokes with me and tells me that she's a baco-vegetarian. So she eats bacon, and that's her only animal product. And I told her she's not a vegetarian that way. But nonetheless, they were followed for 7 years, and they were compared with non-vegetarians. And all the vegetarians combined had a much lower risk, about a fifth lower risk for colorectal cancer. And we all know that beans, a lot of times, take a little getting used to if you haven't eaten them regularly. But if you do eat them regularly, and this study followed almost 2 million participants, I want to point out there that this study is just an unbelievable large amount of people, right? We never see studies with 2 million people. But nonetheless, those who consume the most legumes and soybeans had the lowest risk for colon cancer. And legumes, many health benefits were posited by the authors because of the fiber, the protein, vitamin B6, E, isoflavones, etc. And I will point out that you can take all these vitamins and supplements in pills, but there's actually never been any studies that show that those are beneficial. In fact, we know that vitamin E might actually harm people. So it seems to be that when it's in the plant matrix is when we get the best benefit. So instead of eating thousands of dollars of vitamins every year, spend your time eating fruits and vegetables and beans. So how about osteoporosis? So one of the most common things I hear about is, doc, I'm going to eat this way and I'm going to wither away and my bones are going to break and I'm going to be a boneless chicken on the bottom of the table. And I always tell people that's not true at all. Remember that most of Asia consumes no milk and they have some of the lowest rates of osteoporosis in the country. So if you look here, this was a meta-analysis in women, and basically what it showed was that there was no association between milk intake and hip fracture risk, and the same was true in men. And the way we know this is if you look at that CI, which is a confidence interval, when it crosses the number one, which is unity, it means there's no effect, and it did this both times. So bottom line is milk doesn't do a body good. In fact, it does a body harm, and this is the most important study, I think, that came out in the last year that confirms this. This was in the British Medical Journal, which is one of Europe's biggest, most important medical journals, and they looked at two large Swedish cohorts. Now, this one actually made it to TV this year, if you saw the news. Did anyone ever see this study on the news back earlier this year? No, all right, well, maybe you don't watch TV, which may be a good thing, but nonetheless, two large Swedish cohorts, one with about 61,000 women, another with 45,000 men, followed for 20 years. And in short, what it showed was that if you are a woman and you drink 3 glasses of milk a day, that your risk of dying goes up by 93% compared to women who have no dairy whatsoever. 93%, that's unbelievable. We'll get to questions at the end. So I want to share with you that this is a really important thing, and you can extrapolate this, that this may be any form of dairy. And in this country, it's not uncommon to have a glass of milk in the morning, or milk in your cereal, some cheese on your sandwich, and maybe some cheese on your salad or something at night. So it's very easy to get 3 servings a day. And some of my patients drink gallons of whole milk every week, which I don't recommend. And with each glass of milk, hip fractures increased, which is pretty powerful stuff. So what about yogurt? So this was a really interesting study. So this one looked at participants that were part of the Enrica study, followed for 3.5 years. And basically, they did surveys to figure out where people's mental and physical health were. And basically, if you had a serving of yogurt a day, there was no effect on your mental or physical health based on survey. So again, interesting stuff, because yogurt is being pushed as the panacea for us. So how about blood pressure? So another study came out this year. 121 patients with type 2 diabetes were followed. They divided them into 2 groups depending on how high their blood pressure was. One was uncontrolled, where their top blood pressure number, the systolic blood pressure, was more than 135, and the other was less than 135. They looked at them in a 3-day diet analysis, and the group with the uncontrolled blood pressure consumed more protein and meat than the group with the controlled blood pressure, and the people who had controlled blood pressure ate more carbohydrates. So again, there may be something in the foods that we're eating that's doing bad things to us without us really realizing it. So how about eating your greens, right? So if you are a plant-based eater, you know how important greens are. They're an excellent source of calcium. They have loads of nutrients that you can't really get anywhere else. And new work followed the diets of cognitive abilities of about 1,000 older adults, older than 81 on average. And if they had 2 servings of greens in a day, they had significant decrease in the rates of cognitive decline. In fact, they were thought to have the cognitive ability of someone 11 years younger. Now, everybody in this room knows somebody who's had quote-unquote Alzheimer's disease or dementia of some sort. It's a plague. And I would tell you that the number one cause in this country of dementia is probably vascular disease. That means that if you have heart disease or peripheral arterial disease or erectile dysfunction, you have vascular disease, probably. And the vast majority of this is also affecting the brain. And when it affects the brain doesn't work very well, and you get dementia. Your memory doesn't work so well. Your cognitive abilities don't work so well. So by changing around what you eat, you may actually be able to live a long life and remember it, which is always a plus. So, how about eating carrots? So, interestingly, this was a really neat study. Eating fruit and vegetables was associated with greater flourishing in daily life. So, they looked at 405 young adults, most of which were women. They followed their entries of foods for 13 days, and the people who ate the more fruit and vegetable diets had greater well-being, curiosity, and creativity, which is pretty amazing. So that means that if you are suffering from writer's block or you can't solve a problem in your life, try eating vegetables only for a few days and see what happens. Maybe you'll get your solution. How about joint pain? So I get this a lot. A lot of my patients say, "Doc, I'd love to exercise. I think what you're saying makes sense, but it hurts." So I always tell people there's always a way around that. But believe it or not, by switching around your diet, you may actually be able to decrease your inflammation and improve your arthritis. One of my patients tells me that he can move his hands, that he couldn't move his hands very well before he went plant-based, and now he can do whatever he needs to do. One of my patients said that their knee pain went away. I can't explain this other than through a common theory of inflammation, but believe it or not, this study shows that if you have more pain, you're likely to have higher LDL, which is the bad cholesterol, and higher triglycerides, which comes from usually highly processed foods. And tendon injuries also seem to come along with higher inflammation, with higher cholesterol. So again, switching your diet around to a plant-based diet makes it so that your cholesterol is lower, your inflammation is lower, and your joint pain could go away. And the same may be true for gout. So again, in the Singapore Chinese Health Study, they followed about 63,000 people. Those who consume the most poultry and fish had the highest gout. But those who consume the most soy, protein, and legumes had the lowest risk. And for those of you that have ever had a gout attack, it is absolutely miserable. I've had patients screaming in agony, and there's very little you can do about it until it goes away. So how many people have seen this picture on the bottom? It's like a Norman Rockwell one, right? Back from the 1960s and 50s, where you'd serve this giant pork loin for dinner, and that's what people would eat. But nonetheless, when you look at this one, and this was a really interesting study that's not in the normal medical journals that I follow, but it was interesting. They looked at 76 samples of meat, beef, chicken, and lamb, two modes of production, organic and conventional, quantified the level of 33 carcinogens, and strikingly, the consumption of the organic meat did nothing to reduce the carcinogenic risk. So if you go to Whole Foods and you go to the back counter where the meat is, they have that little scale that goes from 1 to 5, and all their beef and red meat can't ever get above a 2 because nobody is humanely treating these animals. But further than that, none of them are really that expensive. So the other day I was at Whole Foods, I was checking out, the guy in front of me had nothing except for a little brown wrapped package, 2 steaks in there. He spent $95. Yeah, they were grass-fed organic cuts. $95. Do you know how many beans I could have bought for $95? Holy mackerel. But anyway, so you know, people are buying this stuff thinking it's great. And I would tell you, it's probably not great. You probably could have gone and bought the same, you know, poor cuts of meat from Walmart. It's still going to hurt you. So try to avoid it. So let's visit fish. So that was the last thing I gave up when I did my sort of road to veganism. And a lot of it is because there's a lot of data out there that's very confusing. And everyone cites the Eskimos. The Eskimos, they're living forever, which is totally false. So when you look at this, there was a study done in the 1970s by two scientists, Bang and Dierberg, and they never even investigated coronary disease in Eskimos, but yet they're quoted very highly as saying that Eskimos don't have coronary disease, which is totally wrong. There was a study done this last year, 2 years ago, in 2014, where they looked at 700 manuscripts that had Eskimos in the subject. They filtered all the ones out that had nothing to do with health, and they came up with 43 of them. And they looked at them all, and they said, our conclusion is that this hypothesis, that is the one that Eskimos live forever without heart disease, it lacks a solid foundation. Most studies found that Greenland Eskimos, as well as the Canadian and Alaskan Inuit, have coronary disease as often as their non-Eskimo colleagues. So Eskimos have a similar prevalence of coronary disease as non-Eskimo populations, but have excessive mortality due to stroke. Their overall mortality is twice as high as the non-Eskimo populations, and they're likely to live 10 years shorter than their Danish counterparts nearby. I have a very good friend who works in Alaska. He takes care of a lot of patients. And he would tell me that there is massive obesity, there is massive heart disease, massive stroke, and a short life as a result of this all over Alaska. So what I would tell you is whatever people are telling you about fish, I would really consider getting rid of it. And if you don't want to do it for health, do it for the environment. The statistic is if you buy a pound of tuna, 5 other pounds of fish were killed to get you that pound of tuna, and our children are going to have relatively fishless oceans if we don't make a change. So a bit about walnuts. So it's very interesting. Those of you that follow Caldwell Esselstyn, a good friend of mine, we work together very closely. As was mentioned, I am now, thankfully, the chair of the American College of Cardiology's Nutrition Committee, so I get to work with him very often. And he is quite the character. But what he says, if you ask him, is no nuts. And I said, come on, no nuts at all? Come on, there's a lot of data out there that says that no nuts. He says, well, if I let people have nuts, they're going to eat peanut butter. They're going to eat nut butters, nut cheeses, nut oils, nut this, nut that, and before long, everything's nuts. And he's right. If you eat nothing but nuts, you're going to gain a lot of weight and probably do bad things to yourself. So he says, you know what? Maybe you can have 3 walnut halves a day. So that's what he really says if you press him hard enough, and he'll probably never admit that, so don't ask him. But nonetheless, there is quite a bit of data about nuts out there. Walnuts. 112 participants were followed, and they were at risk for diabetes into 2 groups. One received dietary counseling basically saying, don't eat too many. The other one said, eat whatever you want. Both groups were followed and further divided into subgroups that were instructed to eat 2 ounces of walnuts per day or avoid them. The participants were then switched after 3 months, and those who consume walnuts improved their endothelial function and lowered total and LDL cholesterols. The group who was instructed to eat the daily serving of walnuts without the calorie restriction increased body fat. So remember, calories are calories, and if you're going to eat a jar of the most delicious pistachios and peanuts, you obviously are going to have a problem with weight. Now, what I would tell you is these days it's possible to get shell-less everything, right? You can get a big bag of pistachios and quickly get in a big handful, peanuts, whatever your favorite nut is. And I would tell you that it may make sense if you're trying to watch your weight to keep the shell on because it's slower to get at those nuts, and the shells don't taste good. So. All right, so eggs are extremely controversial, and in this last year, there has been a lot of discussion about it. There was an analysis of 14 studies that showed that if you eat eggs, you have a 19 and 68% increased risk for developing cardiovascular disease and diabetes. So a 68% risk goes to diabetes and 19% to cardiovascular disease if you ate the fewest eggs. And for those who already had diabetes, the risk for developing heart disease jumped to 83%. So the authors said, our study suggests there's a dose-response positive association between egg consumption and heart disease and diabetes. What that means is the more eggs you eat, the more diabetes and heart disease you get. And remember that the average egg, and these are the small ones, 187 milligrams of cholesterol. If you go to the store, you can get these giant jumbo eggs. You can even get these very strange bird eggs that are like gigantic in some stores. They're loaded with cholesterol. In fact, the FDA won't even let you call an egg healthy because it exceeds the cholesterol allowance. So you'll never see the word healthy on the side of an egg carton. But let's look a little bit more at the data. So in this last year, about 11,000 participants from the ERIC study, those who ate the highest intake of red and processed meat had a higher increased risk of total stroke. And in the sub-analysis of stroke type, those who had the highest red meat had a 47% increased risk for an ischemic stroke, which is a type of stroke. But in the same study, they looked at people who ate eggs, and those who ate the most eggs had a 41% increased risk for hemorrhagic, a bleeding type of stroke, compared to those who consumed the least. What about this? In South Korea, they looked at 23,000 people, and this was one of the Samsung Health studies. They sponsor a lot of studies there. Those who ate the most eggs compared with those who ate the least had a higher coronary artery calcium score, 80% higher, in fact. And what that is when we do a CAT scan of the chest, because calcium is a metal, we can see it. So if you look at this little figure here, the heart is in the middle of the chest, and then this white stuff shouldn't be here. That's calcium on the coronaries. And so in short, if you do a CAT scan on someone who has symptoms or doesn't have symptoms for that matter, if they have coronary calcium, it shows up. But the biggest controversy this year was the U.S. dietary guidelines for adults. For those of you that are not familiar, the U.S. releases these every 5 years. There was a ton of controversy about this. Basically, what they did is, for years, we were saying 300 milligrams of cholesterol is all you should have in a whole year. A whole day. And where did this number come from? Nobody knows. It's an artificial number. It was an expert consensus. There was no data behind it. So the U.S. dietary guidelines said there's nothing to support this. We're removing it. And so the egg industry said, yes, And they said, go ahead, eat whatever you want. Cholesterol doesn't matter. However, thankfully to our committee, which is filled with a lot more powerful people than I could ever be, we actually submitted something to the USDA, and they put in there, eat as little cholesterol as possible after they took out the 300 milligram requirement. Now, that was very quietly hushed up by all of the major industries. And so the big champion was, don't worry about cholesterol, eat all the fat you want, it doesn't matter. But really it does, as I've shown you already. And so in short, they came out with three diets that they consider healthy. And this is a major move in the right direction. One was Mediterranean, which by and large is a vegan diet with a few weird things that they should probably get rid of. And then a vegetarian diet, which mostly we follow, although they should get rid of the eggs and the cheese. And then this so-called healthy American diet, which I've never seen. It's a ghost. So nonetheless, that's what they recommend is the three ways to eat. And I would tell you that the Mediterranean diet, if you take out the little bit of feta and maybe a little bit of lamb, by and large is a vegan diet, which is pretty amazing. Vegetarian diet was interesting because the guidelines lump dairy milk and soy milk together. So it doesn't make any sense. It's like comparing totally different things. But nonetheless, and then if you look here, we already know that if you look on the right side of that line here in the middle, that if you eat more cholesterol, it's likely to raise your cholesterol. So that's why they put that in, and I think they realized the data is there. So thankfully, the American College of Cardiology, which I do a lot of work with, has come out with these posters for patients. And for those of you that have not visited cardiosmart.org, I would encourage you to do so. Lots of great information on there. But in short, they're telling people to eat the Mediterranean diet, the DASH diet, which is the dietary approach to stopping hypertension, or a vegetarian diet. And it even says here, the dietary pattern cuts out meat and in some cases, seafood and dairy. This was absolute heresy for any major society to actually say. And now it's actually becoming mainstream. So I'm actually really excited about it. But even more controversial was what the World Health Organization said. So hopefully you guys have seen this. If you haven't, you must be living under a rock. But overall, the working group has now classified consumption of processed meat as carcinogenic to humans on the basis of sufficient evidence for colorectal cancer. And they basically said a positive association with the consumption of red meat was found for stomach cancer. And the consumption of red meat was also associated with pancreatic and prostate cancer. And they said that this was on the same scale as smoking cigarettes. So a lot of my patients, I work at a respiratory hospital, have given up smoking. They're eating bacon every day. I tell them they might as well go back and smoke, right? It's ridiculous. And people don't realize this. They serve piles of bacon at the American College of Cardiology for breakfast. They serve piles of bacon at every hospital in town. Every doctor's lounge, I can't even believe there's so much bacon in there. So what I would tell you is we have to really start practicing what we're preaching. And piles of bacon are not a good thing to go. Not a good thing to have. So what exactly is red meat? Well, according to this group, it is any unprocessed mammalian muscle meat, beef, veal, pork, lamb, mutton, horse, goat meat. And believe it or not, if you've ever eaten at IKEA and had one of their Swedish meatballs or Burger King, you may have had horse meat. So for those of you that are horse lovers, be careful. But it was in the news for the last several years that there has been horse meat contamination, whatever that means. Processed meat refers to that has been transformed through salting, curing, fermentation, smoking, and other processes to enhance flavor. And it contains pork or beef and other red meat products, poultry, liver, meat byproducts, and even blood. And the report specifically names ham, hot dogs, sausage, and jerky as the biggest offenders. So what I would tell you is, for those of you that are still eating this, or you have people in your life that you care about, stopping at Santiago's and buying them those $2 burritos is not going to be a good thing for them. And a lot of people eat 6 and 8 of these every day. I don't know if you've ever walked in that place. You should do it just as a field trip. But it's like a giant grill filled with like chorizo. And they're putting it out as fast as they can produce it. So don't do it. All right, let's switch to brain power. Diet records and cognitive health tests from about 28,000 men as part of the OnTarget study and the Transcend studies were reviewed. Those who consume the most fruits and vegetables had the lowest risk for cognitive decline after a 56-month observation period. And a low-carb diet was almost twice as likely to gain more than 10% of their body weight, 59% increase in all-cause mortality during this study. Remember, Atkins himself, the original low-carb guy, had heart disease. He died from a fall, which is what their group tells him, but he had heart disease and a weak heart at that. And cutting fat better than cutting carbs, 19 obese studies were admitted to the NIH Clinical Center. They followed them for 5 days. They were randomized to the two different diets. The reduced fat diet was associated with significantly greater body fat than the reduced carb diet. So perhaps all calories aren't equal. And then for diabetes, I would encourage you to take a look at this. When you monitor the fiber intake from cereal, fruit, and vegetables, Those who ate the most fiber had an 18% drop in diabetes risk, and higher fiber consumption had lower body weight. And further, a meta-analysis showed that there was a 9% drop in risk of diabetes for every 10 grams of fiber consumed. And fibers from cereal were the best, like oats. And another study showed that 200,000 people were followed. Those who consumed the most eggs had a higher chance for diabetes. So if this hasn't helped you really get rid of eggs in your diet, really consider it. They are not helpful. And the question I often get about egg whites versus egg yolks, none of these studies has ever fully separated it out, but they usually include anybody who consumes any egg product. And diabetes is really a disease of fat excess. So if you read any of the books by Dr. McDougall, The Starch Solution, etc., you could basically feed people, diabetics, nothing but carbs, and they could actually put their diabetes into remission, provided that there's no fat in their diet, and I'll cover that in a minute. But in this study, 12 college-aged men on a standard diet were put into a high-fat study diet, and basically they did muscle biopsies on them, which are really painful. I'm surprised they let them do that. But anyway, those who consumed the high-fat diet experienced a threefold increase in endotoxins 1 hour after their meal and lost the ability to metabolize glucose. And we already know, and I presented research from a couple years ago, that when you eat like a big, heavy, fatty meal, a double cheeseburger, for instance, the endothelial cells that line your blood vessels essentially shut down for several hours while your body tries to clear them. So there's a really famous guy out there. He's not alive anymore, but his studies and his work is well known, Walter Kempner. 1940s at Duke University, very prominent guy. At that point in society, if you had major heart disease, you were massively obese, or you had bad diabetes, you were just likely to die, usually within 6 to 12 months of the diagnosis. There was nothing they could do. So he took these people in, and he basically fed them white rice and sugar, fruit, and that's it, 3 meals a day, white rice and fruit. And they had marked improvements in weight, blood pressure, and diabetes. So if you look at this, the people in the black on the bottom here, basically the people who followed his diet, were the ones who were still alive, which is pretty darn amazing. And that was just people, it says here, treated at least 1 year and continued to be supervised on treatment. And the people who followed this diet were alive, whereas everyone else, most of them died. So believe it or not, you can feed diabetics white rice and fruit if they're willing to do that for 3 meals a day and cure diabetes for the vast majority. How about prostate? So 926 men diagnosed with prostate cancer as part of the physician health study, those who can add 3 servings of dairy products a day, 76% more death and 141% higher risk for death due to prostate cancer. And remember that prostate cancer seems to be climbing. 1 in 6 are diagnosed with prostate cancer in the U.S. every day, second most common cancer in America, and every 3 minutes a new case is diagnosed in this country. Another study, 15 study meta-analysis following 842,000 men, 4 eggs a week, that's not a lot, 14% higher risk of advanced prostate cancer. And if you look at the Aventis study, the same thing. Those who followed a vegan diet were less likely to be obese and 35% less likely to have a prostate cancer than those who followed the other types of diets. And as we know, erectile dysfunction is a pretty major problem in this country. The statistics are at 50-50% of men, 60-60-70-70, and by the time we're 100, we're out of luck. New studies show that 50,000 middle-aged men, those who ate the most berries that contained all these anthocyanins, flavonoids, and other antioxidants, had the lowest risk of erectile dysfunction. And if you exercise with this, you had an even better. And believe it or not, if we look at glands, analysis of dietary patterns show that people that were vegan had a 52% lower odds of overactive thyroid. And the same was true for hypothyroidism that I demonstrated last year. But most interesting of all is there's this new virus that was discovered, and it was a bovine leukemia virus. And it's in breast tissue, and it was strongly associated with breast cancer diagnosis. And about 60% of people with breast cancer seem to have this. And the researchers found that about 40% of cows used for beef and 85% used for dairy were infected with this virus. So maybe breast cancer and its increasing prevalence is due not only to diet, but perhaps the virus too. Now, beets are incredibly in vogue, and for any of the athletes out there, people are drinking loads of beet juice, eating the beet greens before they exercise. It markedly improves athletic performance without the same issues of doping with Epogen and other types of drugs. And it actually works simply because it contains organic, naturally occurring nitrates. And in short, it reduces oxygen consumption for the muscles. It makes the muscles work more efficiently. So I'm almost done. After all these slides, how's your eyesight? So in this study, nurses' health study, health professional study, those who consumed the most carrots, tomatoes, spinach, oranges, and other foods had a lot less risk for acute macular degeneration. So it seems to be affecting almost everything. And this one says, I've been working on my core, and I'd be remiss to not just quickly touch on the environmental impact. 1 kilogram of beef, 27 kilograms of greenhouse gases. When you go vegan, it's like not driving 1,100 miles or more. And for each acre of forest that's cleared for urbanization, 7 are raised for meat livestock. The water footprints are just insane. 2,500 liters per one piece of cheese versus 650 liters of water for a pound of barley. So I just want you to be conscious of there. We're doing well this year for water, but California still needs some. And if we could get less California beef, we could have some really amazing results. And of course, we could probably balance our budget and our healthcare costs if we could get most of our lifestyle-related diseases, which is about 3/4 of the $3 trillion spent every year, if we could get those reversed. But there is hope. James Cameron's wife opened the first all-vegan school. So kids are learning how to live this way, and they don't have to be the social outcasts. When all their kids are eating ham and cheese roll-ups, they can eat kale and spinach, and no one makes fun of them. And believe it or not, where I trained last for cardiology, Philadelphia has finally put in the first ever passed tax on sodas, which is pretty amazing, 1.5 cents per ounce. As a result of that, Philadelphia has been on a hiring spree in their government. So for them to be able to hire that many more people means there's a lot of soda and Kool-Aid drunk there. And of course, success here is 100% whole grain, minimally processed, whole food, plant-based diet. And geniuses agree that nothing will benefit human health and increase our chances of survival on Earth as much as an evolution to a vegetarian diet. I'd encourage you to read all these books. And a couple of closing jokes. You think vegans are extreme. I bet you choose a vegan over a slaughterhouse worker to babysit your child. It's not you, it's meat. The vegan breakup. And with that, I will take questions. Right. So the question was, is how do you get people to accept being plant-based? So first, what I would tell you is, in social situations, when you're around omnivores, it's very difficult to have this discussion, right? What the old joke is, how do you know if someone's vegan? They tell you, right? So the truth of the matter is, you have to be careful because, you know, socially, this is not necessarily universally accepted. In a medical situation, it's different, though. So what I say to a patient is, can I be critical of your diet? And if they say no, then I don't say anything because they're not ready for it. It's kind of, they have to be accepting of it. So when a patient says to me, I want to be on less medicine, or can I be critical of their diet, and they say yes, then we go through it and I say to them, my goal here is not to ruin your day, but to get you off these medicines. You're not supposed to be on a medicine for 50 years or 60 years or 70 years. And a lot of times the goal of getting off of medicines and feeling better is really what motivates people. And I think that's a key thing that you can't get when you're having dinner with your neighbor. And it's very, very hard for people to get that. But the other thing you can do is pick up food or invite people over your house and prepare foods vegan and don't say anything about it. Let them eat it and say, oh my goodness, this actually tastes good. Right? I had somebody the other day who's like, you know what, tofu is the most disgusting thing I've ever had. And I said, well, I would agree. When I grew up in New York, if you went out for tofu in the Chinese food restaurant, you got a block out of the package, and that's what they served you. I would agree that's not so good. But if you go and you get it seasoned properly, prepared properly, you get the firm stuff, it tastes great. Go to Chipotle. Try their sofritas. And every person who's ever tried the sofritas is like, you know, I thought it was going to be absolutely gross, and I really loved it. So I would tell you that it's all about getting people kind of constantly poking but gently, and being supportive of whatever it is they choose. And it's not an easy thing. I've had patients go to the patient advocate at my institution. You know, they've had 4 bypass surgeries, and I'm like, you can't eat hot dogs anymore. And they say, and they want a new cardiologist after our visit. So what am I going to do? You can only try. So.
some companies are giving incentives for at least educating smokers again for smoking. Is anything going on with the same thing for diet?
So what I would tell you is in the insurance industry, there's a bit of a recognition that people who follow this type of diet live longer. So if you haven't seen me before, I shared my own story that when I went vegan, about 6 months after doing it, I redid my own life insurance physical and they sent me a rebate because I moved to their special highest lowest risk category. So that kind of stuff works, but in a widespread setting, it's not quite there yet. Some of the blues are experimenting with more plant-based approaches. People are realizing that this makes a difference, but it's not at the forefront. And I would tell you, you know, with MACRA that came out, for those of you that are not familiar, it's a big governmental program to try to make sure we have good quality and all that. But in short, we're going to be switching finally towards a model that promotes ease instead of dis-ease, right? So the goal is to make sure that people are following a preventative approach because it's a lot easier to get somebody intensively counseled up on why they should change their lifestyle than having to pay $100,000 for a bypass surgery. So,
I personally follow my sister's diet. I estimate that I'm probably eating 80% carbs, 10%, 80% carbs, 10% fat, 10% protein. I feel great. Everything's wonderful. But with respect to people that have cancer, which I don't have, but I know a lot of people that do, cancer cells can only eat sugar, carbs. So is a diet like this make sense for cancer patients as well?
So I'm not sure that statement's exactly right. The question was about cancer and carbs and sugar. So it is true that all cells require sugar and carbs to replicate. There are some amino acids in animal products that can help actual cells reproduce. And in general, I'm not an oncologist, but what I would tell you is the true pathophysiology, the mechanisms behind the disease and cancer development are difficult to sort out. And it could be that all of those toxins in the animal products that we were eating triggered some sort of abnormal DNA repair, which then led to a cancer. And then afterwards, believe it or not, a plant-based diet can sometimes halt or regress a lot of the cancer development. So I guess what I would tell you is it's difficult to say the correct answer to that because no one studied that directly. You know, for instance, it's a lot easier for me to hit up a drug company that has a $500,000-$600,000 per year drug and say, let's study your drug versus going to Chiquita Banana and say, hey, can I have some money to do a cancer study? They're going to say, we don't have the money to give you. So the bottom line is, I'm not sure if there's a great answer in that regard, but I would tell you that there are certainly some animal products and some amino acids, in particular in some of the animal products, that can trigger cancer growth. So I guess what I would say is I would keep doing what you're doing. Most of the cancer societies in this country endorse a plant-based diet as a preventative. So
if you have a busy day and you can't prepare a plant-based meal,
right,
do you endorse any type of supplement, like a shake, a protein shake, or a veggie shake or something?
So what I would tell you is I have those busy days every day. Oh, the question, sorry, was if you're busy and you don't have time to prepare a plant-based meal, should you have a shake? And what I would tell you is I have those busy days every day, and the key is to plan ahead. And if you can't, these days you can find plant-based frozen foods, even at Target as an example, which is surprisingly becoming very vegan-friendly. You know, Target carries that Just Mayo brand and all their cookies and other stuff and treats and whatever. I don't recommend them as health foods, but they have them, which you never would have anticipated years ago. But they have a whole section of burritos that are plant-based. So that's one quick option. You can get wonderful Indian meals in pouches that you can microwave very quickly, brown rice bowls that you can microwave very quickly, and have a meal in 2 minutes. So what I would say is supplement shakes and protein shakes are probably not necessary, but if you want one, there's a couple of wonderful pea-based protein shakes. I'm sure there's going to be some of the exhibitors out here that are very delicious. And you could, you know, in a pinch, if you had to do that, I would say you could do it. But I would say that you could probably get whole, unprocessed foods a lot easier. So
my husband is interested in transitioning slowly. He loves his meat and cheese, and he's been listening to me for 5 years. So he's interested in taking baby steps. Are there any resources specifically for men to help them along in the transition? I know there's great resources that I've seen in general.
Right.
More male-based.
So the question is how do you separate a man from his barbecue? So and I would tell you that we still use our barbecue, and I would tell you that there are some absolutely delicious veggie burgers out there. I would take them out to some of the new restaurants that the Root Down Linger, Vital Root just came open, and they have some amazing prepared foods that are fully vegan that are surprisingly unbelievable tasting. I would take him out to a Chinese food place and get him some kind of tofu dish, or an Italian place and get him a pizza, that a tomato pie, crust sauce and veggies, and let him see how good things taste before you take them away. And then you could say, you know what, hon, you can make that pizza on the barbecue. All you need is dough, sauce, and vegetables. Or try this veggie burger, and there's 100 to try. One of them's going to be delicious. Try making tofu steaks. Take them to Chipotle and get them those sofritas. And little by little, see what they can do. And if he's really a hardcore carnivore, some of the products by Gardein and others, like I would say that the Gardein chicken fingers, and I'm not endorsing any product here, are probably the closest to real chicken fingers I could have ever imagined. Now, they're not necessarily health foods, but they're nice if you need that step-down approach. That may be one way to go. So what I would tell you is, in these days, if you go out, you'll see they have hot dogs and bacon and all the stuff that's made out of plant-based products that is surprisingly good. So I guess what I would say is, you got to convince your husband that you want him around for a long time, and you also have to tell him that you want him on less medicine over time, and finally that there are foods that are equally good if you would just give him a chance. And that's the hardest part for anybody. And you can cook anything on a barbecue. A barbecue is nothing more than a heat source. So if you want him to cook stuff out there, let him cook. Let him do the cooking. So.
Years ago in Los Angeles, and I will tell you, not popular in high school. But, you know, after probably 18 years, I started to develop, I believe, an allergy towards soy. And so, you know, I got it back with organic chicken. What I find, and I cook almost every meal, what I find really challenging about most of the vegan meals, there's so much sodium in them, tons of sodium. So I guess when you look at vegan and you look at the product, what's your thoughts on the fact of having 500 milligrams?
Sure. Yeah, so sodium's a big issue. Just for clarity, you know, unless you have high blood pressure, and even if you do, the recommendation is somewhere around 2,000 milligrams a day. So in general, you probably could get away with a little bit of sodium. I would tell you that these days, you know, if you buy a can of beans, there's actually not much salt in them like they used to have. There's things available now that are not that way. And the least processed foods you can buy are the best ways to get the least amount of sodium. So in general, you always have to be wary, right? There's a lot of delicious, I would call fake meats, alternative things that are really good, but they have a full day's worth of salt in one serving. So. So the question was, what about soy? I'm scared of it because it might cause breast cancer, right? So first, almost every major cancer society has rescinded their soy statements. What I would tell you is that organic, non-GMO soy is the only way you should go. The standard soy products in this country are prepared mostly from seed from a company called Monsanto, which has created the Roundup-resistant soy. So if you ever have looked at the side of a can of Roundup, there's like two pages of every rare disease it might cause. So if you eat that stuff, I would not recommend it, and it's on a lot of the soy that you buy conventionally. But soy creates phytoestrogens. Phytoestrogens are plant-based estrogens. When they're in your system, they occupy the same receptor sites as standard estrogens, but are less potent. They don't activate it the same way. Remember that in Asia, they eat 3, 4, 5 servings of soy a day, and they have some of the lowest rates of breast cancer. So what I would tell you is, unless you have a very special type of breast cancer, I wouldn't worry about the soy at all. And I think it's probably a great way to go, but try to buy organic, non-GMO soy. And be wary, a lot of the popular brands out there, like for instance, Silk is unbelievably popular, but it's not organic or non-GMO, although some of their products are becoming that way, which is great because they have a lot of consumer pressure on them to get there. So. So almond milk or any milk you want to consume, they're not really milks, right? Basically, it's ground up soy, ground up nuts, ground up almonds, ground up hemp with water that they put in a sock and they soak it, and that's basically it. So have all you want. Just, you know, be careful that you don't get tons of fat from some of the fattier milks. You know, cashew milk is really decadent and delicious, and I would highly recommend staying away from coconut milk, which is loaded with saturated fat and is exactly what clogs up arteries. That's what we feed to rats in the labs to develop coronary disease. So I would tell you that coconut oil in general is excellent topically and absolutely decadent when you eat it, but I would really limit the amount you take in.
Can you give me a copy of the slides?
Yeah, so you can just email the organizers, or maybe they'll be on one of our websites. And if I remember, I have a website that I don't, unfortunately, have a lot of time to maintain called vegancardiologist.com. So I'll try to put it up if I remember to do that. Thank you.
And
lowering blood sugar with? So I would tell you that you should work with a doctor who is at least familiar with some of the dietary approaches to diabetes, which I would argue is probably almost none in the state, unfortunately. But there are some out there who would at least be willing to try you. But in short, if you can lower the fat content of your diet significantly, you may be able to get your diabetes to go away. Now remember, diabetes is a lot like smoking cigarettes. We count those in pack years, right? So if you smoked a pack a day for 5 years, you have 5 pack years. If you have diabetes for 20 years, you've had 20 diabetic years. The more diabetes you have, the more damage has occurred. And so it may not be fully reversible the longer you've had diabetes. But it could get better and you could require less medicine, that's for certain. I don't think there's ever been any studies that show that. There may be slightly different nutrient contents. Of most sprouted foods have slightly more nutrients. So if you can find sprouted tofu that you like, I don't see any. Just buy organic, non-GMO if you can.
But I listened to one of your colleagues when he think about EB, which actually should stand for early death, because it's a precursor to cardiovascular.
Absolutely.
I've been telling some of my friends that, and they said, that's not true.
Yeah, so erectile dysfunction, and this is a very common thing, and almost nobody likes to talk about it, and I seem to always have female medical students, so nobody wants to talk about it. But what I would tell you is that erectile dysfunction is unbelievably prevalent and has a major adverse effect on quality of life, right? You know, human beings are sexual beings, and when things don't work, things get uncomfortable. And I would tell you that the number one cause in this country for erectile dysfunction is not a urologic disorder, it's vascular disease. Most people don't realize that if they get pain in their legs when they're walking, that's called claudication. That is as a result of angina in the legs, essentially. It's blood vessel disease. That same series of blood vessels also supplies the genitalia. And when there's blockages of blood to the genitalia, bad things happen and things don't work. Viagra works simply by dilating blood vessels, and we use it a lot for the pulmonary beds, but also in the genitalia blood vessel supply. And so in general, what I would tell you is, yes, people who have erectile dysfunction should be screened for peripheral arterial disease, and in the right situation may actually have coronary disease and need further workup, and I would suggest seeing a cardiologist. So great question. Other questions?
Can we see that slide again on what you recommended?
Oh, yeah, sure. So the books here that I recommend, and these are just a few of them, I would say that there's probably 100 wonderful ones out there now. There's the Forks Over Knives cookbooks and their regular books, The Starch Solution by John McDougall, and he talks very much about how to use starches, potatoes and beans and other complex carbs. Believe it or not, a sweet potato is actually a fantastic thing to eat as a meal. And most people think that it's absolutely the side dish and it should be reversed around. The China Study by Colin Campbell. So I went to Cornell as an undergrad. Colin Campbell's China Study was absolutely remarkable, one of the first books that I read. Basically, what he did is he found that if you fed kids peanuts with aflatoxins and they were eating a standard omnivore diet, they all got cancer. And give them milk, for instance. But if you gave them those aflatoxins and they didn't have that in their diet, they didn't get cancer. Pretty amazing. But then he also looked at the rural Chinese and compared them to the urban Chinese, who had a much more Western diet, and they had none of the diseases, the rural ones. Plant Eat is a wonderful documentary and book. It's all about the environmental effect. But probably one of the real interesting books is Diet for a New America. So this is by a guy named John Robbins. You might know the chain Baskin Robbins. That's him. His family told him to inherit the Baskin Robbins fortune. He said, no way, this is going to hurt people, and instead wrote this book. Very eye-opening book. And it's not a new book. It's been around for a long time. And there's probably 50 other books out there. Joel Fuhrman's work, Esselstyn's book, you name it. There's so many wonderful books out there. And if you can't find a great recommendation, come find me or email me or whatever, and I will get one to you. But there is no shortage of documentaries. There was a wonderful movie that is coming out that contains a lot of these people, and I'm in there for about 20 milliseconds, called Eating You Alive, which hopefully will be screened in Colorado a few times in the coming months. I encourage you to watch that. It's a really neat documentary. And for those of you that have not seen Forks Over Knives, the movie, wholly eye-opening movie. And then lastly, if you want the truth in a way that would hurt you by watching it, the movie is called Earthlings. And it's narrated by a guy named Joaquin Phoenix, who happens to be an actor. But it is the most disturbing movie that shares the unshielded truth with where all your animal products come from. So, by and large, look out there. There's wonderful resources.
Is there a way to diagnose the presence of hard or soft plaque with your symptoms without machines and so forth?
So the question was, can you diagnose hard or soft plaque in your coronary arteries without a machine? So for clarity, hard plaque is calcified plaque, and soft plaque is non-calcified plaque. And the terms you're using are sort of older because people wanted to be more precise. But in short, there's really no way to tell the difference between the two. And I would tell you that if you grew up in this country, and I don't know how old you are, but let's say you're older than 60, chances are you already have some degree of plaque. The average man at 70 in this country has plaque in their coronaries, and sometimes quite a bit. In years prior when I was here, I presented data from the Vietnam War and the Korean War. All of those vets who were 21, 22, 25, carrying those really heavy backpacks and machine guns before we had all the modern metals and whatnot, in the prime of their life, when they did autopsies on them, they all had plaque, whereas their Korean and Vietnamese counterparts did not. And the reason for that was probably because they ate rice and vegetables and maybe some fish, and we ate roast beef and potatoes that was shelf-stable for 5 to 10 to 20 years. So bottom line is, there's not an easy way. But plaque isn't necessarily a problem. And a lot of people don't realize this, but when your arteries start to get blocked, they first positively remodel, which means they get bigger to accommodate the potential loss in lumen, the flow size that in the coronaries. And then as the plaque gets more and more, then it encroaches on the lumen and restricts blood flow. And only about at the time that 70% of that lumen is blocked is when coronary disease shows up with chest pain or shortness of breath. So there is no magic way to tell you by looking at you if you have coronary disease, with rare exception. But if you're having symptoms with activity, that almost always means there may be a heart problem, and I would encourage you to get checked out. Yeah, so it's interesting. On my work group at the American College of Cardiology, one of the major authors of the PREDIMED study, which is the Mediterranean diet study, is Emilio Ros. And he would tell you that you can drink olive oil till your heart's content. And I would tell you that if you do that, you'll get very heavy. But I would tell you that if you look at the olive oil and the Mediterranean diet compared to an American diet, there's marked improvements in outcomes. But no one has ever done a study of a vegan, low-fat, plant-based, whole food diet versus the Mediterranean diet, because the Mediterranean diet would probably lose. So what I would tell you is, if you're going to use oils, to use them sparingly. And I mean really sparingly, not gallons and cups and whatever, but sprays or sprinkles of it. You can saute vegetables very easily with water, believe it or not. There's some pans they're selling outside that, you know, you don't need any oil at all. So, you know, look at it and again, see what you think. But I would tell you that too much oil seems to be a bad thing. And if you're going to use oils, olive oil and canola seem to be the safest. But again, I would be careful. The U.S. Dietary Guidelines for Americans would suggest liquid oils, olive oil and canola being the chief ones of those, and avoiding tropical oils like coconut and palm. So yes, so the question was, talk about sugar. So you need sugar to live. Sugar's in all the things that we enjoy. But when we isolate things out of plants is when people get sick. Right? So for instance, you used to be able to suck on a cocoa leaf, you'd be like having coffee. Now if you super concentrate the cocaine, you could die. And if you take in really, you know, a beet and you filter out all the sugar out of the beet and you eat the sugar, it could potentially create problems with metabolism of glucose, inflammation, and triglyceride formation. So what I would tell you is, sugar is probably meant to be eaten in the form of the plant that it comes in. And that's the best way. And if I had my druthers, I would avoid all sugar-sweetened things. And I would encourage you, if you have a sweet tooth, to try grapes or dates. Dates are really pretty decadent. And then there's a couple of places in Colorado where you can pick your own strawberries, and they're mostly organic, i.e. they're not officially labeled as such, but there's no bad things. They're like this big, right? How many of you have bought a strawberry this big at the store? Nobody. But they are just nature's candy that way. That's unadulterated, ungenetically modified strawberries. So go out there and experience the fruits and vegetables the way nature intended, and you probably won't need added sugars. Yeah, so vitamins and supplements, yeah, is a great question. And I would tell you that vitamins and supplements are probably not needed. If you eat a well-balanced diet and you don't have some anatomical issue that prevents absorption, you don't need them. But if you don't eat well, or if you eat only, you know, rice or only beans and that's all, and you never get any of the brightly colored fruits and vegetables and deeply colored fruits and vegetables, you might be vitamin deficient. As you know, vegans are supposedly B12 deficient. Most people who are vegan these days were not vegan to start with, so they usually have a massive store of B12 to start. But if not, eating things like nutritional yeast is a great natural way to flavor your foods and get B12. Many of the soy and almond milks are supplemented with B12. Again, it's very hard to be B12 deficient. But in general, I would tell you, most vitamins and supplements end up in our urine, and your urine is that really bright color, and that's exactly all the vitamins going right into the sewer. So you might have expensive urine that way. But again, in the right person, it makes sense. And I wouldn't recommend a supplement if you're eating well. Vitamin D. So the question was about, what about vitamin D? So I would encourage everybody to go outside and exercise. And for those of you that did not pick up the flyers on your chair, those are Walk with a Doc flyers. I'd love for you to take them with you and come walk with me and my colleagues as we talk about health issues and get people really moving in some of the most beautiful parks in Colorado. But exercise outside when you get some sunlight on your skin, 10, 15, 20 minutes at the most, is probably perfect to develop vitamin D. And if you need vitamin D because of a deficiency for whatever reason, taking vitamin D is probably not harmful. Right, so your vitamin D level is a little low, what you're saying, and you know, being outside without sunblock on and with enough skin showing, right, you have to have the sunlight actually hit your skin to do the thing it needs to do. So you might want to go out in a bathing suit for 20 minutes and then go put on whatever else, and that might help you. But also, some people would suggest that there's a synergy if you eat mushrooms, for instance, and vitamin D formation in particular. So you might try that, and if not, taking a vitamin D supplement is probably not a bad idea. Yeah, I don't know the specifics on that particular study, but there seems to be some link with mushroom intake and vitamin D availability, so I would encourage you, if you like mushrooms, to eat them. Yeah, okay, so there's something on nutritionfacts.org, and Michael Greger will be here tomorrow, and you can ask him. He and I both are from New York, so we both talk quickly, so I apologize. So.
As far as like high carb or high fat or
both? Sure. So I take care of a good number of patients that have multiple diseases that make them catabolic. They break down everything they eat and they're wasting away. So first, your body mass index should be greater than 17 and a half or 18. If it is, then you're fine. If you want to be heavier, then you probably would eat more carbohydrates and more flours, ideally whole grain flours. But carbohydrates that are ground up are much easily absorbed. So if you eat ground up breads and flours and other things like that more often, and you have to really eat all day long for some people, that's one way. The other way is you may have to liberalize your fat intake, which in special situations makes sense. But if you eat, you know, an avocado, that's a lot of calories. If you eat one of those vegan cookies, right, those could be 400 or 500 calories each. So there's ways to get a lot of calories in your system if you want. You could eat a jar of peanut butter. Again, I don't recommend that, but if you're really underweight, a jar of peanut butter is, you know, several thousand calories. So, you know, you have to kind of be careful what you do. There's a plus and a minus, but eating more often is probably the easiest way to go. Any other questions? Wow.
You said if you're going to have oils, that's canola or olive oil for best?
Right. You have to find the organic, non-GMO the best you can. And then I would tell you that olive oil is the least processed of any oil. It's basically olive juice, right? I mean, they just press it. Whereas all the other ones have to do like some other high heat, mechanical, yada yada stuff that I don't claim to fully understand. But nonetheless, olive oil is the least processed of any oil, and that may be why it has potentially more of the health effects and benefits. And again, you have to be careful. If you watch 2020 or read Consumer Reports, all the extra virgin olive oil you may be consuming may not be extra virgin or even olive oil, which is pretty scary. The same thing is true of fish. For those of you that are still eating fish, if you go to a store or a restaurant and you order red snapper or tuna or whatever, the likelihood of it being red snapper or tuna is something like 1 in 5. So in general, you never know what you're eating. Just like if you go to Burger King or IKEA, you may get horse when it says beef. So. Yeah, so great question. So as we have found out on numerous occasions, first, the countries that consume the most dairy have the most osteoporosis. And what it appears is that the American diet is too high in protein. So the average American consumes 200-300 grams of protein a day, sometimes more. You only need 30. Somebody your size probably needs 30, maybe 40 at the most. When you take in extra protein, your kidneys dump calcium. Osteopenia, which is the step before osteoporosis, is basically a calcium balance issue. That means that you're peeing out more calcium than you take in. And the goal is to hold on to that. So then we're doing calcium supplements. Calcium supplements are ground up shells mostly. I don't know about you, when I go to the beach, I try not to eat the shells, but that's what we're doing. And in short, the best way to get calcium in your system is not through shells, but rather green leafy vegetables. Kale, spinach, broccoli, even some of the tofus are extremely high in calcium. So consider that as your best way to go. And then of course, exercise is critical to maintaining bone health. So dairy I recommend against at all costs. Yeah. So, and I would tell you that dairy is incredibly linked to cancers and bad outcomes. And as a woman, if you heard what I said about the dairy, 3 servings of dairy a day raises your risk of dying by 93%. So whereas you may get calcium, you may get protein in your dairy milk, you also get a whole bunch of other stuff you didn't ask for. So.
I love the idea of the walk with the doc. I have a question. Free coffee and breakfast. Can I assume the breakfast is vegan?
It is. So, yeah, so good. So what there is, and it's not like a full breakfast. I'm not making tofu scrambles or whatever, but it is fruit, fresh fruit, and unfortunately, the best I can do is granola bars, almost all of which are vegan, and there's coffee. And there's always soy or almond milk, and then, of course, Starbucks gives me a big thing of cream for the people that need it, but by and large, there are vegan options. Okay, yes. So remember that all women become postmenopausal at some point, some much earlier than others, and there's a lot of issues that affect women, and you probably know lots of them. Most of the public is aware of them, and I would tell you that, by and large, vegans, as best I know, don't necessarily fare any worse. They may even fare better because they eat more soy more regularly. And there has been a study that showed that hot flashes and some of the more awful symptoms of menopause are a lot less in vegans as a result, which is kind of neat. So I guess if you're going to be entering menopause relatively soon, consider being vegan so it won't bother you as much. So. Walk with a Doc is a national program that started in Columbus, Ohio, and it's not fully Republican if that's what you're worried about. But what I would say is that in general, it is a nonpartisan, wonderful group that is nationwide, and there are more and more chapters starting all over the country. In the Denver metro area, we have 5 doctors who participate in Walk with a Doc. And there's even a walk on Sundays in the summer as well. If you check our website and our meetup group and our Facebook page and all that, you'll find all the information. Or you can go to the national website, which is walkwithadoc.org. And there's even chapters in like Saudi Arabia, Canada, Hawaii, all over the place. And I'd encourage you to check it out. Our program here in Colorado has grown. It's 6 years old now. We usually have in the summertime at least 100, if not 150 people at every walk. It's a great way to meet like-minded individuals, and I encourage you to bring your friends, your family. There's all kinds of free stuff, and you also get an expert in a topic coming to talk to you about some issue, which is pretty powerful. So yes, so VegFest is one, and there's usually a doc or two in the crowd. You don't have to admit it if you don't want to. But I also do grand rounds where I go to the various hospitals and I talk to the various doctors that are available and come to those meetings. I also teach the residents at St. Joe's Hospital, so I do a talk for them every year at the very minimum. And then I also am working on some national webinars for other cardiologists. On top of that, I'm also invited annually to speak at the American College of Cardiology's Heart House to a whole slew of mid-level providers, nurse practitioners, physicians assistants, etc. So little by little, we're making headway. And then, of course, there's also a national program called ViewMedi, which is a webinar for doctors. And I have people like Dean Ornish and I who work together to do these wonderful education talks. The best thing that I got to do this last year at the American College of Cardiology annual meeting, there's 40 to 50,000 cardiologists there. We led the first ever full-day lifestyle intensive, and we had a debate about the best way to diet. It was Esselstyn and Agatston, the South Beach diet guy, and Neil Barnard, and a whole bunch of people were there. And then Dean Ornish did a whole talk on love and connectedness and the data behind it. And that was the first time at a heart meeting that there was discussion of hearts, love. So it was pretty amazing. So.
Well, I'll say that recently we had a relative in the hospital here, and not only the patient's food, but the food available for visitors, et cetera.
It was terrible. We are working on a national level on a hospital food program to address this exact issue. It is an incredibly difficult process because everybody wants ranch dressing and hot dogs in every hospital. Now, the good news is the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, my friend Neil Barnard, has been working very diligently and has almost eliminated every fast food restaurant from every hospital in this country. So we're almost there. But that doesn't mean that they don't serve the same foods now. So.
Since doctors are not trained in nutrition, what is your advice to counter bad nutritional advice given to patients by doctors? For example, my stepfather was told by his doctor that he didn't need to drink water because all liquids count as water. Which means you can drink beer and alcohol and coffee and milk and get your daily water intake.
So there are some issues about this. So first, if some people have heart conditions that would make them retain fluid, water, fluid of any sort is still fluid. Being that if that's not the case, I would say that I don't know about that advice necessarily, but you don't have to drink water. It is true you can get by on beer alone, but then you might become an alcoholic and have liver problems and other things, so I don't recommend that. You could get by on coffee alone, but you'd have to drink a lot of it because coffee makes you pee out most of your water anyway. So it is true you could do those things. I don't recommend that necessarily, but it is true that the vast majority of us that dispense nutrition advice have no nutrition background. It's like calling a plumber to fix your faucet. He's like, I don't know how to do that. So what I would say is that a lot of it, unfortunately, is on you to find somebody who understands this stuff. There are a few doctors out there who do understand nutrition, but there aren't a lot, and it's unfortunately a little bit of a difficult thing. Many of my patients who are vegan, when they go to their primary care doctor tells them that they're crazy. So in short, if you find a doctor like that, get a different doctor is the best way I could tell you. And maybe give your doctor a book. Maybe buy a Michael Greger's book or Joel Fuhrman's book and say, why don't you read this and see what you think? Last question, I think we're out of time, so.
They did an interesting study on nutritional medicine, and they asked a group of physicians basic questions about how much calcium you take, vitamin D, and what type of dental you want. And they gave the same questionnaire to the receptionist or to the doctors, and yes, we did better on the test. The receptionist, by
some oh.
The advice I would give the questionnaire was make the appointment with the receptionist.
There you go. Ask the receptionist for advice. Okay, probably wouldn't recommend that always, but anyway. All right, last quick question.
Okay, I just like to quickly comment. I have a patient that Dr. Kessel, that is in the seminar, and at that point, I had run into Dr. Freeman, and I asked him who he recommended in Denver, and he said, no, that's a cardiologist.
I don't know if that's me or you.
Probably. Anyway, his comment was, and later on came back up, and he said, the only cardiologist that I recommend in Colorado is Dr. Freeman.
Wow. Look at that. Well, thank you for that. All right, well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, everyone, for being here today. And come back at noon for our first training demo of this weekend. Less than harder, the road. Vegan Roadie.